Silence. All rise. Please be seated.
Yes, Ms. Rees.
Commissioner, I omitted to tender this morning the two emails which had been provided overnight and which were referred to by Mr. Hickey in his further cross-examination of Ms. Quartermain.
Yeah, do you want to identify them?
I should have identified them. They don't have a document number at the moment. They are PDF documents.
Yeah, yes, what are the dates of them? From whom to who and the date? Well, we'll attend to it later.
Sorry, Commissioner. I do have them. The first one starts with an email from Alicia Quartermain to Kathy Allen on Friday the 20th of November 2020. And the second chain starts with an email from Alicia Quartermain to Kathy Allen on the 25th of November 2020.
So that's the first email, is it?
The first email in time, in fact, goes in that first document, is an email from Kathy Allen, which is somewhat before, it's in early November. It doesn't have a date. But the documents, if they need to be identified, both commence in the way that I've just explained. And they are saved as CJA email 1 and CJA email 2.
Right, Exhibit 65.
Thank you.
Yes, Ms. Hedge.
Commissioner, I call Angelina Keller, spelled K-E-L-L-E-R.
Keller, will you take an oath or make an affirmation?
An oath, thank you.
Sorry?
An oath, please.
Yes. The evidence which you shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but truth. So help you God.
So help me God.
Thank you. Ms. Hedge.
My name is Angelina Keller.
Yes.
And you're currently employed as a scientist in the reporting team by Queensland Health. Is that right?
Yes.
At the Forensic and Scientific Services Laboratory. Right, thank you. You provided a statement to the Commission. I'll just have that brought up on the screen. It's WIT.0003.0435.0001. Recognise that as your statement?
Yes, I do.
I tender that, Commissioner.
Exhibit 66.
Do you have a copy of that has the exhibits? We can provide one to you. Oh, that's in front of you there if you do need to refer to it.
Okay, thank you.
We zoom in on this page, on paragraph 5, please. 4 and 5. We just established that you're a scientist at the DNA laboratory. And in paragraph 4, those are the duties of a reporting scientist, interpretation, reporting and reviewing results.
Yes.
And giving evidence in court.
Yes.
And you joined FSS in 2004, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And between 2004 and 2010, worked in a number of teams that we see there, the analytical team, the volume crime team, the intelligence team.
Yes, that's right.
But from 2010, you've worked in the reporting team.
Yes.
All right. I'll ask you to speak a little louder for me, just so I can hear you clearly.
Yes.
Now, we see at the bottom of this paragraph that in 2006, you applied for and were selected to be trained in all aspects of bones as part of the Skeletal Remains Project.
Yes, that was the beginning of my journey with bones.
And can you tell us the types of occasions on which your laboratory would deal with a bone sample?
So bone samples come to our laboratory for testing, sometimes through litigated cases, but mostly it will come from a coroner who would like to establish DNA identification through testing of unknown skeletal remains. Also, disaster victim identification incidents. So
disaster victim identification.
Yes. So if a plane crashes and there's a number of individuals on board, normally more than three or three or more than three. Not always, though. It depends on the amount of fragmentation that occurs. So this is established by the coroner as to whether or not it's a DVI incident. And then testing will proceed through DNA if it's deemed necessary. And it's a very important function performed by our laboratory.
So these are airplane crashes where the impact is so great that the that it's not possible to identify people just by looking at them to see who they are. So what remains is for you to look at bones that are given to you so that you can then identify from the you can extract DNA from bones and or somebody, you know, the bones are worked upon so that in the end a profile can be obtained from the bone and an identification can be made.
Yes. And sometimes that can be tissue, but it depends. And if a plane does crash, every plane crash is different. I've worked on 10 DVIs now since 2006, and every DVI is different. It doesn't matter if it's a plane crash, they're all different. There can be car crashes, floods, fires, explosions. But if we have a plane go down tomorrow with 300 individuals, you can imagine it would be
yes.
a massive task.
Now, you spoke of three main situations. DVIs was the third. The second was coronial investigations, where a coroner asks for assistance from the DNA laboratory. Is that right?
Yes.
And can that be true both in recent cases but also in cold cases or very old cases? Is that fair?
Yes. The laboratory has tested some remains this year, skeletal remains, that have been aged at approximately 100 years old by a forensic anthropologist. That's not my role, but that was from the forensic anthropologist and it was an approximation. So we can have 100-year-old bones or older. We can have 50-year-old remains. It just depends on the remains that have been located by sometimes it's general public that will find the remains or it can be police. It's highly variable, but I have worked on a number of cases, cold cases, that involve men 20-year-old remains that eventually were able to establish their identification through the coroner's assistance with DNA testing.
And you mentioned that your work is very important, in particular for missing persons. How does the identification of a bone or the DNA in a bone assist in that process?
So if remains are located, they come to our laboratory and the coroner will have to deem that DNA testing is necessary. We need appropriate permissions. These remains are then profiled for a DNA profile, and if it's a believed to be unknown deceased person, we may receive reference samples from the family that are still with us to make a comparison to the DNA profile that's obtained, and hopefully we can actually give some statistical weighting around a possible familial association between the reference samples and the unknown remains. And then we provide a written statement to the coroner, and then he will or she will accept the DNA report, which will be taken into account often with other information that we're not privy to. To establish identification or not.
That might resolve, mean that a missing persons case is resolved or solved. Is that right?
And it could be any number of, it could be a murder, it could be just someone that accidentally lost their life at some point. I mean, that's not up for us to establish that. We just obtain the skeletal remains and do the best with the testing that we can possibly do.
Yes, but you're aware that that's the consequence of your work.
Yes.
And the first type of case you described was what you described as litigated cases. And do you mean by that cases going through the criminal justice system?
Yes. So sometimes we do bones for litigated cases. They might know who that particular set of remains are from, but because of decomposition, so they might have been established through circumstantial. The coroner might accept identification through circumstantial or dental, for example, another very important mode of identification that we use in any sort of identification case. And so if identification is established through dental, for example, then it's not necessary to establish identification also with DNA, and therefore the purpose of profiling bones at that point is if we can't obtain a DNA profile from blood, for example, because maybe it's been 6 weeks up in North Queensland and decomposition is an issue, and then it will be DNA profiling from the bones that will actually enable us to obtain a reference sample from the known deceased person in that situation.
I see. Mm. To use in relation to other samples for proof.
Sorry.
So I think you said if you have remains where there's been a dental identification or other forms, other means of identification, you then take a DNA sample, and that sample can be used as a reference sample for comparison purposes with other samples that are suspect.
That's right. So crime scene samples for that case. So essentially it becomes a reference sample for the litigated case, the bones. Mm. It doesn't happen often, but it does happen.
Yes.
You also see in here what you were trained in 2006, triaging of remains and autopsy evidence recovery from bones, as well as other postmortem samples, interpretation, reporting and reviewing of DNA results. Is it fair to say that that is a wider range of skills that you have than reporting scientists generally exercise with respect to crime scene samples and other samples, non-bone samples?
Yes, it's a specialised field, and I have a real passion for it, to be honest. It's something I really love, and I feel that being able to help people that are very distressed or have suffered immensely is such an important role that we play in our jobs. I mean, I'm not saying that any case is more important than any other, but I have a real passion around trying to help people that have lost their loved ones or someone's missing and we don't know what's happened, or just trying to bring some sort of closure. And I know that has a lot of meanings around it, that word, but to actually tell a family that that person that went missing 10 years ago, we've given a report to the coroner, and the coroner can tell them, we know what happened, and this is what happened, and now you can have a funeral.
Yes. And your skills and expertise range across what might be done in both the evidence recovery lab, the analytical lab, and the reporting area of the general case flow within the QHFSS lab. Is that right?
I would have to say I did work in the analytical section when I first started working in 2004, and I learned all of the general processes for extraction and quantification, amplification and capillary electrophoresis. But since I left the analytical section, those competencies have lapsed, but I do have experience in conducting those techniques.
I understand you have those skills, but what I mean to ask is, you as one person for a bone sample would do tasks that would be done in evidence recovery, analytical and reporting, whereas right now today in the QHFSS lab, there would not be generally one person doing all those tasks for a crime scene sample.
No, that's right, yes.
There would be three sets of people doing tasks on a crime scene sample.
Yes.
And how many bone samples come into the Queensland lab a year?
That varies a lot. This year we've had quite a few bone samples come into the laboratory, but there are sometimes there are years where there might only be one or two or three cases that will come to the laboratory. If we have a DVI, that that is one incident, but we might have quite a few bones to test as a result of that. But every DVI is different. But generally, it's not a lot of cases for coronial identifications that come through the laboratory.
Right. Can we talk about another difference between bones and general crime scene samples? As a matter of biology, would the internal part of a bone have more than one person's DNA in it?
No, you wouldn't expect to see more than one person from a bone. So if my bones were tested, I would expect to see a single source DNA profile. So a DNA profile will look like a graph, essentially. Each area of the DNA that we test, you'll see two peaks represented on this graph. Now, if I look at a graph and I see three peaks at one area that we test, that will indicate to me there's a possible mixture present.
So if we had what looked like a blood sample and is a blood sample, it's possible that that blood found at a scene has been contaminated by somebody else's blood, or by somebody else's saliva, or by touch. And so when you test that sample, you wouldn't be shocked to find a preponderance of the DNA from the blood, but also some other indication that there was more than one source for the DNA. So it's not a single source, it's multiple source, correct? But with a bone, although the exterior of the bone might have multi-sources, you literally drill or cut into the center of the bone, into the interior of the bone to get your sample. And so by definition, you're going to get a single source of DNA, and subject to deterioration, a pretty good DNA profile. Is that right?
Yes, we'd expect to see a single source DNA profile.
So what you're saying was that if you dig into a bone as you do, cut into a bone to get your sample, and you get a profile showing it's multi-source, well, you know it's not multi-source. It must be something else.
It indicates a problem.
Yes. Sorry. Go ahead.
So can I ask about a fourth difference between the treatment of bones and the treatment of general crime scene samples? And kind of, seriously, is this correct? You have, as a scientist in the lab, interaction with a wider range of other agencies than for an ordinary crime scene sample, where the main interaction would be with the police. Is that fair?
Yes.
So with bones, you might deal with the coroner.
Yes.
The mortuary.
Yes.
Perhaps some emergency services if it's a DVI incident.
Well, that tends to come through the police.
Yes, all right. And the police as well.
The police, yes. Often the points of communication can be, because we have a liaison unit and they may also be in contact, but it's not unusual for the mortuary potentially to get in touch on behalf of pathologists. Pathologists can get in touch with you. The police, who are associated with the coroner, may get in touch. For a DVI, it's another set of police officers, but again, the police officers, forensic odontologists, which are the dentists that do a lot of the identification work. I have quite a good working relationship with many of those. And the police officers deal with circumstantial aspects and fingerprints, which can be very relevant to any sort of coronial identification case. But essentially that encapsulates more professionals than we would normally encounter when we're doing routine casework.
So unlike your colleagues in the reporting section of FSS, you tend to have a real case management role, I gather, in that you speak to the investigators, you speak to other investigators in the dental specialists and fingerprint specialists. So you speak to a range of people across the face of the investigation, whereas, as I understand the evidence from your colleagues so far, they tend to see the results. They don't tend in general to deal with the investigators, although that does happen from time to time. Is that a fair summary of how it works?
Yeah, I often will get a phone call, random phone call to my desk, and it will be someone associated with an identification case ringing for me for specific advice about something.
Yes.
Which is not so common with all of my other cases.
Yes.
We turn to page 0.0009 of the statement, please. Saying, Ms. Keller, that I'm zooming on paragraph 61, please, operator. She was saying that those are particularly specialised area within the laboratory, and this sets out in the middle of this paragraph which staff members are currently trained to either sample or report on bones. Do you see that there?
Yes.
All right. And so in terms of sampling bones and teeth, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people and one in training. Is that right? And in terms of reporting, there are 4 people, including yourself.
Yes.
And you're the only person who appears on both of those lists, so you're the only person who can do the full case management from receipt of bone right through to reporting. Is that fair?
Yes, I'm the only reporting scientist that actually performs an evidence recovery task. There used to be Ingrid Muller as well. She also used to sample bones in evidence recovery, but her competency has lapsed. And there used to also be Timothy Gardam, who's no longer at the laboratory, and he was an expert in skeletal remains because he actually contributed to my training. So he's been working on bones for longer than I had.
And in terms of people who are currently at the laboratory, are you and Dr. Muller the most experienced in that group?
Yes.
All right. Now, this is a part of your statement where you set out the process of dealing with a bone sample when it comes in. Is that right? And you say there that an email is sent to staff who are trained to see who has availability to sample.
Yes.
Right. And the purpose of that, of having a roster, is to ensure that everyone maintains their competency because there's only a few samples a year.
Generally speaking, yes. I think this year has been quite busy, to be honest.
Right. Good competencies to have more samples coming in, is that right?
Yes.
All right. Could we zoom in on paragraph 62 and just deal with this general process of bones before we get into some of the concerns you raise? This is the process that scientists might be requested to assist a pathologist with the selection of bones from a sample. And can you tell us who pathologists are?
So the pathologists are the doctors who are performing, very specialised doctors, performing autopsies, and as part of that they may need to be sampling a bone or having a bone sampled for DNA. There are a number of pathologists who I regularly have contact with or hear from in the workplace, but yeah, at times they request your assistance to help with selecting whether it's a bone. Sometimes it's a tissue that they're not sure about, but they just want to check in to see what is the best sample that they can take to ensure the best chance of obtaining a good quality DNA profile without taking extra time.
And that the pathologists would be doing their work in the mortuary?
Yes.
And the mortuary is on the same site as the lab at Cooper's Plains?
Yes.
All right. And so once you've selected a bone or a tissue or teeth sample, would the pathologist in the mortuary package that in a way that's appropriate to transfer to the lab?
It gets transferred. So, and I must add that if you touch teeth, you always need the blessing of the forensic odontologist because that's critical to their role. So we don't routinely do teeth unless that's sort of all there is for DNA, and we have to make sure that the forensic dentists are finished with the teeth because that's a very important way that identification can be established.
Yes.
But once we have clearance and the sample is taken, a bone sample or tooth sample, it goes across to Property Point and then it's properly registered in the forensic register system that we use, because forensic pathology doesn't use the same system that we use, so it has to be properly registered. Yes. And then it is transferred across to DNA, provided all of the communications are in place to indicate, yes, this bone needs to be tested for DNA, because we don't want to be touching remains that are not required to be tested.
Right. Now, if it's a bone, we see there at B that you would, if you were allocated to it with another sampling scientist, you would take it to the bone room, which is near the evidence recovery laboratory.
Yes.
And you would deflesh it and remove the edges of it. Is that fair?
Yes, because the ends of the bone have been normally cut in the mortuary environment, and this has a lot of biological contaminants present.
And then in part C, we see you would, from that inner part of the bone that you've obtained, you would chisel it into small fragments and then use a cylinder to crush it.
Yes, it's the bone fragments are placed in a sterile cylinder with bungs and an impactor in the centre, and it is placed on a mount in a bone crusher with liquid nitrogen. And then it is started, the machine is started, and the impactor, which is inside the cylinder, actually it just moves very quickly and crushes the bone, smashes the bone into bone powder.
Yes, and so liquid nitrogen makes it very cold.
Yes.
And brittle.
Yes.
So that when the impactor hits it, it shatters into lots of pieces. Is that the idea?
Yes, that's right.
All right. Can we turn to the top of the next page, please, operator, top of page 10? Then you have a fine powder of just that internal part of the bone, is that right?
Yes, and I just want to say that with for long bone, for example, it's like a hollow cylinder, and in the very centre of the bone is where the marrow is, but we actually, bone marrow tends to, it doesn't keep well, and so we remove that centre. So the actual bone that we get into is around the circumference, but internally of the circumference, if that makes sense.
Yes. So it's the internal cylinder of the bone with the external parts of the bone removed. All right. And the marrow from the centre removed also.
Yes.
All right. And then how much powder are we talking about?
It's 0.1 grams.
It's a very small amount.
Small amount. That's the aliquot.
We call it an aliquot. Just go to the one above that first. What you get out of the bones,
it depends on how much bone is actually in the cylinder, but we normally store the stock bone in a 5 mil tube, and then we take the smaller aliquots from the 5 mil tube, and we call it stock bone.
Right, and the aliquots, which we see there weighed out and transferred to the analytical team for processing, that is the 0.1 grams that you just mentioned.
Yes, and we normally take four of those, so four aliquots from the bone powder or stock bone.
Right, and then the analytical team do the actual processing, extraction, quantitation, amplification and capillary electrophoresis, is that right? And then it comes back to you with an electropherogram to interpret.
Yes.
All right. Now, that bone crushing equipment is obviously highly specialised equipment.
Yes.
That you use. What about the chisel that you described? Is that a specific DNA analysis tool?
It is a normal chisel that you can actually buy from a hardware store, but it is prone to rusting, because it's not titanium, or it's not, it actually has components in there that every chisel, normal standard chisel, will have. But obviously we're using it in a laboratory, so we need to clean it properly. And it's dedicated equipment. It's not, it stays in the bone sampling room and it doesn't move anywhere else.
Right. We'll come back to cleaning in a little while. Could I turn then to paragraph 47, which is on page 7, please, operator? You say currently you are seeing mixed DNA profiles, multiple contributors in bones/teeth aliquots for a number of coronial cases.
Yes.
And what does that indicate to you, that you're seeing a number of mixed profiles come out of bone or teeth samples?
Well, it tells me there's a problem. We are not seeing these mixtures in bones that or teeth that are fresh. So fresh bones are ones that might be from a recently deceased person. So there's still blood within the bone. Whereas if you find skeletal remains that are 50 years old, you're not going to be expecting to see blood in those remains. It's going to be cells that actually form the bone. So the mixtures that we are seeing, these, the mixtures that are occurring are happening to older bones or even bones that are not that old, maybe around a year before they've been located.
So when you say that fresh bones have blood in the bone, that's in the actual cells of the bone, not in the marrow?
Well, the bones actually have channels that run through them, and that's where you have all the blood vessels running into the bone. So I'm not talking about marrow, I'm actually talking about the blood that runs through these channels that are within the bone. If, because when you sample a bone and you have the bone powder, if the it's a very fresh bone, you will see that it's almost a salmon colour, which
it's almost what?
Like a salmon colour. Yeah. It almost indicates that you can see there's a bit of a red tinge to them.
Yes.
And it's because it's obviously includes some blood cells within this bone powder.
So when we talk about that cylinder of bone, within the cylinder itself is channels for blood vessels to go through, is that right?
Yeah.
And so when you crush that, you will actually crush that blood vessel with the blood in it.
Yes.
Is that right? So then blood's part of the powder.
Yes.
All right. Now, when did you first notice that you were getting mixed profiles from bones?
It was a case in November 2020. We actually, I think the first time I really noticed it, I didn't really register as being, it was a problem in my opinion. However, We sampled two different tissue types. I think we had teeth and we also had bone, and they both showed mixtures. So, yes, I was aware of it. I thought it was very unusual. It's the first time I can really remember that happening. The chance of obtaining a mixture from two different tissue types, I just didn't have a good explanation at the time. But since then, it's happened and more frequently, and now I'm at the point that we've got a problem and we've got to find out what's going on.
And before November 2020, starting in 2006 when you were training this,
yes.
In that intervening period, did you receive mixed profiles from bone samples?
I never came across a case. We occasionally will see contamination. I know with mitochondrial DNA testing, it's quite a common thing because it's a very sensitive testing process. What has happened since 2006 is processes are getting more and more sensitive, and so every now and then it does occur that we will see mixtures occurring. However, with resampling or reprocessing or further work, it was resolvable. So we could obtain a single source DNA profile in the end, and we were able to report a single source profile to the coroner.
Because the extreme sensitivity, am I right in this? The extreme sensitivity that's been introduced with new technology over the last few years means that you'll get false peaks that might look like a two source when it should be a single source, but that successive testing will show when you see a range of profiles that they are indeed false peaks and ought to be ignored. Is that what you mean, or something else?
Well, yes, it could be a contamination in one aliquot for the bone, but you may not see it in the other three, say, if you've got four aliquots. Or you might go back to the original bone that you sampled and go again. So, I mean, resampling, recrushing, reprocessing, and then we wouldn't see the contamination.
I see.
So there would be.
So it really speaks of a contamination issue rather than a stochastic artifact.
Yeah, currently I would say it's occurring a lot. Previously, it would occur rarely, and I would say that it, like you pointed out, as technology has changed over the years. So I've been doing this for 16 years, and there's been new technologies brought in at different points. And as things become more advanced, more sensitive, we are seeing this more and more.
So, in the past, before 2020, mixtures were rare. And in your experience, always resolvable to a single source profile?
Yes, in my experience, I don't know if any of the other coronial DVI reporting scientists had problems.
Yes.
But in my experience, no.
Never had to report a mixed profile to
no.
the coroner. All right. And do you keep a, do you have an estimate of how many bones you would have dealt with between 2006 and 2020?
A lot.
All right.
I don't know. I'd have to find out if you'd like me to find out.
Would you estimate more than 100 or less than 100?
Be around 100, I would say.
All right. Now, since 2020, have you kept a spreadsheet of bone samples that you've dealt with?
I have been looking at the different cases that we've been testing.
Yes. Can we look at that? It's WIT.0003.0454.0001. And it's attachment AK19 to Ms. Keller's statement. Is this your spreadsheet?
Yes.
We zoom in on perhaps the top 10 rows or so, operator. So this spreadsheet, we see some dates on the left-hand side there. Is that right?
Yes.
See the date sample column for the moment?
Yes.
All right. And so you started... Is this all of the bones that you sampled from the start of 2019 onwards?
No, these are cases that I'm aware that bone sampling has occurred for, or teeth sampling as well.
Since 2019?
Yes.
So starting on the 1st of January 2019?
I believe so, this spreadsheet. Because as you can see from 2019, yeah, we don't receive a lot of cases.
Yes.
So these are all of the bones sampled at the lab since that date, is that what you mean?
In my awareness, yes. Mm. If I've missed some, that is possible, but I was just really trying to track back through the records that I could find, and so this is what I've come up with.
So it's not just ones that you did. It's other ones that you're aware of or that you could search for using the forensic register.
Yes.
All right. And so we see there in the tissue column, bones or teeth, and then in the result column, the first five say SS, that stands for single source.
Yes, and this is what we want to see. We want to see a single source profile.
All right. And on the 12th of March 2020, do you see there's two there together, one bone, one teeth?
Yes.
And the bone says partial SS, so partial single source profile. And that means there just wasn't peaks in all of the locations that you look at on the DNA strand.
Yes.
How many is the cutoff to be called a partial?
Because we're testing there's 40 possible pieces of information, not including a meal agenin, which is the gender indicator location. We're looking for 40. And so obviously I don't recall from the top of my head how many, but I know that it wasn't a full DNA profile. So there weren't 40 pieces of information for that particular case. But that one, we actually identified, we obtained a full DNA profile from a tissue sample, so not a bone sample in that case or the teeth. It was actually a tissue sample. But I actually just wanted to note it, that was what we obtained from the bone sample.
Now, we see a number are reported as no DNA. Is that done in the same way as we've heard about crime scene samples? That is, if the quantitation falls below 0.001 nanograms per microliter, it's reported as no DNA?
I'm not sure. It possibly was one of those cases for that particular sample, those ones that I can see on the spreadsheet right now. I would have to go back and double check that for you if you'd like me to look, but it had very low levels of DNA.
Is the reporting of no DNA done under the same standard operating procedure as for all casework samples?
Yeah, so bones and teeth samples were under the same umbrella.
Okay, so if that standard operating procedure says under 0.001 no DNA, that's what would be the result here?
Yes, so I would imagine it that is actually a no DNA in that sense.
Yes. All right. On the far right, we see linked and fresh. Could you explain those?
So the two cases on the 3rd of the 8th and the 13th of the 10th, those were linked. They were the same site, but they were just recovered at a later time. And that does happen. Sometimes you might have a site where the police will recover remains and then they recover more remains at a later time. So both of those cases are linked in that sense, same location.
What about the fresh? How fresh does bones need to be for you to describe them like that?
That was a very recently deceased person.
But is there a cutoff? Like, for example, 7 days, or is there some cutoff between when you would call it fresh and not?
I guess that's just my terminology that I'm applying in this spreadsheet, and it's more as a mental note for me to understand, okay, we've got a single source DNA profile from this particular bone, and that was a fresh bone. So it could have had blood still contained in the bone that was able to be profiled for DNA.
Right. So by the time a bone comes to you, has someone else given some estimate of how long it's been since person's deceased?
So sometimes we'll have missing persons, and it will be for it could be a crocodile attack or something like that. So the police will be aware they've gone missing on this date and then remains are recovered on this date. So from that situation, you understand it's quite a recent, and it might be a matter of days between missing and recovery of remains. And then it's a matter of actually obtaining a DNA profile. So I would say that situation would be fresh.
Okay. And can you give us an estimate of how long the period is while you'd still consider it fresh? Is it a matter of days or weeks or months? I'm just trying to get a general idea.
6 months. Right. I would not be expecting to see fresh blood in bone at that time frame.
I think I'm not asking the question very well. Let's try again. What time period since becoming deceased would you call a bone fresh?
Days, weeks.
Okay. And would you do that based on the time frame that police or the coroner have told you, or would you do that by visually inspecting the bone?
I might have information around if there's a believed to be.
Yes.
Where there's a date where the person was last seen, that might be a rough idea in my mind that, you know, this has been a week. And then I'll be looking, but I sort of have that in the back of my mind. It's not until I'm actually reporting a statement for the coroner that I tend to look at that sort of information. Sometimes I do, but when you actually go in to sample a bone, you assess the bone and you look at the condition, you have a look at if it has flesh adhering to it that needs to be removed, and it could be decomposing tissue. But if you've got skeletal remains that have no indication of any soft tissue adhering, then the indication is that it's an older bone. You know, it could be a year old, could be 10 years old. And it just depends on the environment the bone is in as to what sort of condition it's in. And we do assess that when we sample the bone.
Yes. And so that level of condition will be highly variable even for bones of different ages. Is that fair?
Yes, because if you have a bone that's in a marine environment versus a bone that's in the middle of the desert and it's in a cave somewhere, like completely different situations, and it will affect the DNA that's contained in the actual remains.
All right. Operator, could you zoom in on the next 10 lines or so? Thank you. So you described I said, when did you first notice a mixture, and you said November 2020. Is that the two, a bone and a teeth sample we see there, 2nd of November 2020 and 26th of November 2020?
Yes, that's the case I'm talking about.
All right, and complex unsuitable means a mixed profile?
Yes, it does.
And how do you remember how many proposed contributors were in that profile?
At least two.
Right.
But I it could have been more. I would have to go back to the case.
And so if we look down through here, through this, can we look at the next line, 15th of March 2021, a bone sample, 1 times mix, 3 times single source. Can you explain what your notation means there?
Okay, so again, this is a case that we have taken 4 aliquots of bone powder for. And from one of those aliquots, we've obtained a mixture. And for 3 aliquots, we've obtained a single-source DNA profile.
All right. So all 4 of the aliquots are tested together, is that right? By
yes.
That I mean at the same time,
yes.
Not in the same tube.
Yes,
obviously.
No. Yeah, they run separately but together.
All
yes.
Right. So in a case like that where there's 1 mixed profile and 3 single-source profiles, you can report did you report a single-source profile?
Now, I'm just trying to recall that case because it's de-identified. In that situation, I could tell you what I would do. I would fully disclose that to the coroner in a statement. So, and it's possible that one of my colleagues reported this and I may have reviewed the case, or I'm not sure exactly. However, you could report the 3 aliquots as being single-source DNA profiles, and you could also report that you obtained a mixture. And then you would provide a statistic based on one of the single source profiles that provided the best quality result. But full disclosure to the coroner, because that is what we've been having to do.
Yes.
And so I've got, from the time you discovered, first encountered this mixture on the 2nd of November 2020, there are 18 samples you've listed. 15 of them returned a mixture and 1 returned no DNA.
If that's what you've
so
just...
only 2 returned a single source, correctly.
I just want to clarify with
yes.
you that in 2020 we did actually profile 13 bones as part of a DBI, so I haven't listed those on this spreadsheet,
mm-hmm.
and we obtained single source profiles from those samples,
mm-hmm.
and I believe from the top of my head it was 13 bones, so no problems. They were fresh though.
So when was that in 2020?
It was just at the as the pandemic was beginning in March of 2020.
So in the first 6 months of 2020?
Yes.
Right.
And
so they wouldn't be included in the commissioner's statistics that were from November 2020 onwards?
So it becomes 15 erroneous mixtures, 15 single source and 1 no DNA. So 50% mixture rate where you should be getting single source. Yes.
I haven't actually done the statistics, but it was already concerning me greatly as each case has come along.
Mm-hmm. Well, a 50% failure rate's not very good, is it?
So if we look at those samples on the 24th of March 2022. Do you see those three?
Yes.
So all these notations mean the same as the one you've just described. That is, the first is two aliquots resulted in a mixed profile, two with a single source for the first one?
Yes.
Three aliquots, single source, one for a mix on the second one on that date?
Two single source.
And four mixtures on the third on that date. All right. Now, if we look at the 1st of June 2022, eight times mix, does that mean you did eight aliquots and all of them resulted in a mixed profile?
Essentially, that particular case was very low level, and that's why we did so many aliquots, yes, because it was very, the DNA was very low. Now, when we're assessing a case like that and it's very low level, I think we had to look at all of the aliquots together. And one of my colleagues and I talked about it, so I put eight bimixes there, but when you look at all the profiles and the extra peaks that are popping in and out of the different aliquots, we assessed them all as being complex unsuitable. We weren't able to interpret them. Actually, I'm, and this is a little bit difficult here, I'm not sure. There's so many cases that I've worked on recently.
Yes.
I'm not sure that eight by mix. Would I be able to, is the information in that folder redacted?
No, it's not. So
can I just refer to,
yes.
Thank you.
Please do.
Because I can't memorize all the cases off the top of my head.
I understand. Found that page.
I found the page. I'm just referring to my statement because I think I have actually listed it in my statement, this particular case. Okay, thank you. So I would like to take back what I did just say and just clarify that that particular case was eight mixtures that we obtained from it.
Okay, so there was eight aliquots?
Yes.
And each of them returned a mixed profile?
Yes.
All right. And was that eight aliquots taken, if I'm testing your memory too far, tell me, but was that eight aliquots taken originally, or did you take four as usual, test them, get mixes, and then take another four?
Yes.
All right.
So I actually did review this case. I didn't, and that's why it's, I think when you're reviewing, you are a little bit more removed from,
yes,
from the case.
Of course.
But yes, so this did actually, this case actually was mixtures.
All right. And so for these ones that, have all mixtures, for example, that one, or those 30th of the 6th 2022 ones, for example, where they're both complex unsuitable, they will be reported to the coroner as a mixed profile?
We are having to. For the one on the 1st of the 6th 2022, they actually didn't know, that was an unknown deceased person. So in those situations, we don't tend to issue a statement to the coroner for identification because we go through a process where if it's an unknown deceased person, then we can load the information to a database that's Australia-wide, and so we might go through that process for an unknown deceased person. And as soon as someone is known, they have to be removed. from that particular database, but that is the process. So if we reported to the coroner, and we could, and I believe in this situation an intel report was provided to the coroner, so that's an alternative to a statement that we provide to the coroner, because we just wanted to give information around the results we had obtained.
And so can we just speak briefly about likelihood ratios? For a single source, you might report either by intelligence report or statement that the chances of the contribution by a particular person is greater than 100,000 or 100 billion or some number, depending on what your calculations result in. Is that right?
So identification cases can be different. So if you're doing a direct comparison, so, for example, they're my bones, you go to my toothbrush, for example.
Yes.
Hopefully get a single source profile and then do a direct comparison between the antemortem DNA profile, toothbrush, to the postmortem DNA profile, my bones, and get a match. And then in that situation you can do a direct comparison that you've just described.
Yes.
However, if you didn't have my toothbrush, you would have to go to my parents. So you get a DNA profile from my mum, a DNA profile from my dad, and then we could perform a calculation which involves looking at your relatives, and then we provide a statistic. And it can be a very high statistic, but in that situation it tends to be lower and we report it differently. And so coronial identification statements are a little bit different to the statements we provide for the crime scene samples matching to a reference sample, for example.
Okay, and so is the likelihood ratio then the likelihood that the sample is related to the relative?
Yeah, we call it a paternity, in the situation mother, father, missing person, it's a paternity trio calculation that we perform on a different statistical package, and then that statistic goes to the coroner.
Okay, so that's single source. How would you report a mixed profile to the coroner?
So the only time I've ever had to do this in my life is this year. And it wasn't that case. It was another case. I believe it was the one from the 24th of the 3rd. I can't recall exactly off the top.
That's
of
okay.
Again,
just
it's
generally
the details. Yes. So we did actually have to look at a mixed DNA profile.
Yes. But
that was
let's use those two examples that you've given. The first is the toothbrush example.
Mm.
So if you were reporting a mixed profile to the coroner, would you be reporting that the person who owned the toothbrush had a certain likelihood ratio of having contributed to this bone sample?
Yes, you could with the direct comparison, yes.
All right. And then how do you explain in your statement, if at all, difficulty with the mixed profile, the fact that it's a mixed profile?
So we had, it was a linked case. And again, my colleague had to, we talked about it, how are we going to do this? So one of the cases that we had to report to the coroner, we did have a single source, and then the linked case had a mixture, and we were able to just say that the unknown that was obtained from the mixed case was consistent with the other case. Now, I would have to go back and have a look at those statements to exactly recall how we reported that case.
Okay. Ms. Hedge, how is this going to help me? Because isn't the point that we're getting mixed results where there ought to be a single source results, and that's obviously going to lead to problems in reporting to the people who are interested in knowing the results, but the precise difficulties faced by those people, I needn't examine those and make findings about them, Nita?
No, we were simply getting to what the problem is in the reporting. That is that the problem is identified in the reporting. That's what I'm seeking to elicit. But maybe perhaps I'll ask that more directly.
Aren't we more concerned with whether there are problems in the lab and what those problems might be that have led to the mixtures?
Yes, but the consequences of that is of some relevance. But
the consequences that the result is unreliable, isn't it?
Well, Well, perhaps we should ask Ms. Keller that. Is that what is the consequence of obtaining a mixed profile from a bone sample? Is it that it's an unreliable result?
I would have to say that the cases where we've listed complex unsuitable, we can't do much more with those cases. Where you might obtain a mixture where you've got a very low-level mixture and a major in the profile that is clearly consistent across the case as being an unknown, we can actually do something with that. But this is not what we want to have to be dealing with. And I've been working my way through these cases with my colleagues this year, and it needs to be fixed.
Yes. So is the essential problem with the mixed profile that you have two DNA profiles and you don't know which of them is the deceased person?
Yeah, you're using the best ability, like all of my expertise in my career, to try and assess whether or not we can use a profile when it falls into that category.
Okay, but tell me if I'm wrong, but is what you're saying that the problem with a mixture is that you might get two or more profiles, people in your profile, and you don't know which of those people is the deceased person?
No.
And which are contamination?
That's right.
So it might be, say, a three-person mixture.
Yes.
Person one might be the deceased, person two and three are some sort of contamination, but you don't know whether it's that or that person two is the deceased and one and three are contamination, or person three is the deceased and one and two are contamination.
Yes.
Is that your point?
Yes, it is very difficult. And I wouldn't report something that I wasn't able to report confidently, but I've never hit this before in 16 years, so it's getting very difficult.
Right. Thank you. So could we just zoom out, operator, and there's three numbers in the far left column. Could you zoom in a way that those three are in and the whole spreadsheet across? Yes, thank you. So you've also annotated this spreadsheet on the far left by three things. Now, does this equate to three changes in the lab that you've observed since you've started seeing these mixed profiles?
Yes.
All right. Now, we'll talk about each of them in turn, but just while we're here on this spreadsheet, is the first of those on the 5th of July 2019 a change to the cleaning?
Yes.
And the cleaning of equipment that you use to sample bones, I should say?
Yes.
All right. And on the 25th of March 2020 is a change to the extraction process? Is that
right?
And then on the 15th of February 2021 is the change to capillary electrophoresis, that is the introduction of the 3500 machine. Is that right?
Yes.
All right. And so that's why you've got those three things in this spreadsheet to show when those changes were made.
Yes.
And you haven't, we'll come to this in a few minutes, but you've raised a OQI about this issue. Is that right? But that OQI hasn't been resolved. There has been no identification of the root cause analysis or root cause of this mixture problem.
We're still working. So I raised the OQI.
Yes.
And now two of my colleagues and I are working through this OQI, trying to come up with recommendations for solutions.
Right. And these three things are things that you've observed in the past that you think might have an influence on creating mixtures?
Yes.
All right. But you haven't yet come to the point in your consideration of it where you could say definitively that one of these is the problem?
No, and I think the point is with three changes that have occurred in, I mean, it's spaced over a little bit of time, but in terms of how many cases we actually come across, it's a fairly short period of time. And so when you change in science, when you change more than one thing around the same time, it gets very difficult to pinpoint what the actual issue is. So that's why I've highlighted three changes, because I think they're all contributing to the problem that we're seeing.
Can we go through them in a little detail? Could we turn to page 10 of the statement, please? zoom in on paragraph 64 to 66. So in 2015, there was a project that you described there, Project 148, about the bone crusher vials and how they might be cleaned.
Yes.
Now, that's the part of the process we described earlier, where you described earlier, I should say, where liquid nitrogen was applied and there was an impactor that hit the bone until it crushed into a powder.
Yes.
Okay. So that's what the bone crusher vial is?
Yes.
All right. And it investigated whether you could use Tergazine or something else. Is that right? That project?
The project, the original, because I've gone back to the project, the original reason that Timothy Garden commenced that project was because we had changed process and he was noticing a few more of the peaks that Walter was talking about, sorry, the commissioner was talking about before, around can we find a better way of cleaning, because we're finding there's peaks popping up now and then in the bone crusher vial. So Tim looked at a number of options in this report and tried to find, I can actually refer to that report because I've annexed it. He looked at a number of options that might be a good alternative for cleaning the bone crusher vials.
And so what did he conclude? What do you... After this project, what did you use for the bone crusher vials?
At that point, I don't think we changed process at that point. I would have to actually go back and have a look at the timeline. But Tim did find that Tergazine is one of the cleaning agents that we use, found that that worked very well for cleaning the bone crusher vials, and he also found that using a dishwasher on a certain setting was very good for cleaning the bone crusher vials.
Okay.
And we have changed to cleaning the bone crusher vials now in the dishwasher, and it does seem to work well.
Right. Can we turn to the next page, operator? And paragraph 68 to 70. So that project only dealt with the vials, is that right?
Yes.
All right. But in 2019, and this is the change that you identified on your spreadsheet.
Yes.
There was a change to cleaning all of the bone crushing equipment.
Yes.
Is that right? And this is the change in paragraph 68. So all of the bone crushing equipment will be used, the dishwasher, bleach and or Trigene. Is that
well,
the 70% ethanol.
So the change was the bone crushing equipment using the dishwasher, but that was just referring to the crusher cylinder and the bungs and the impactor. But then the bleach and or Trigene followed by 70% ethanol was the remaining equipment, and as it's noted there, in line with other evidence recovery and analytical protocols.
Right. So it's the second part of that that's the change you're referring to?
Yes.
And that was applied to I'll withdraw that. As you say in paragraph 70, to your understanding, there's no validation or verification about that change in relation to bones, particularly bones and teeth.
Yes. So that was the using bleach and or Trigene followed by 70% ethanol for the remaining equipment.
Yes.
It is in line with other evidence recovery protocols. However, no other process in evidence recovery uses the equipment that we use for bones. So I've listed that in paragraph 70. So that includes chisels, hammers, chisel blocks, Dremel bits sometimes, hand saws and electric saw also. And
so in your view, because of those that different equipment, was it your view that there should have been a validation before any change in process?
At least a verification or testing. We're going to make this change for this equipment. Does it clean it adequately?
How would you say the difference between a validation and a verification?
I think that a verification, because is not quite as vigorous as a validation. I mean, to be honest, when it's such an important process that we don't do it that often, but it is a really important thing that we do, we should do it properly.
What was used to clean, for example, the chisels before this change in 2019?
So we used a saturated solution of Turgazyme. So we would, in the bone sampling room, have a container, large container, fill it with water and then add Turgazyme and saturate the solution. So you've got excess Turgazyme because it's like a solid.
Yes.
You dissolve it in the water.
Yes, yes.
And
so you use Turgazyme.
Yes.
And then in 2019, Mr. McNevin was put in charge of bone testing. Is that right?
Yeah, he was put in charge previous to that, I believe, but he implemented this change.
And what was his experience in bones? What's his scholarship in bone work?
When Alan was first put in charge of bones, I don't believe that he had any experience in bones or teeth.
So he then decided on the 5th of July 2019 to change from using Turgazyme to using bleach and or trigene followed by 70% ethanol without any testing or consultation with the scientists in the bone unit.
That's right. The first I became aware of it was there must have been a bone to be sampled, and there was an email that came out, and somehow I was aware of a change. I can't even recall, to be honest. There is an email, and I just said, have we implemented a new cleaning process? And it was, yes, we have.
And in paragraph 71,
we have 71 and 72, please, operator. Yes.
You found that the chisels were getting rusty.
Yes, this year. I did notice that there was rusting of the chisels. And I did discuss this with other staff members, and we started to feel that, or agreed that it could be a potential source of contamination.
So the way...
Because rust is a rough surface and it's prone to retain substances with which it has had contact.
Yes. Hmm. And actually Tim's, I think it was a verification that Tim did. He did note a number of things, and he actually did mention that when pieces of equipment go rusty, they can be more difficult to clean and more likely to retain foreign DNA.
Yes. And so this cleaning regime poses two risks, as I perceive you're saying. One is the rusting and therefore the collection of DNA, and the other is just simply DNA on any surface if it's not appropriately cleaned off before the equipment's used again.
I think mechanical action is a very important part of the cleaning process when it comes to any sort of cleaning regime. But
by that you mean scrubbing it with your hand?
Yeah. Right. Yes.
And is that what you used to do in the tub of water with the Turgazyme?
Yeah, you could really get in there and scrub everything very well.
Right.
And it felt, I mean, you knew it was as clean as you could possibly get it.
And had Mr. McNevin, to your knowledge, scrubbed any instruments clean in his work?
I don't know.
Mm.
Not that I'm aware of.
Is that a convenient time?
Could I just ask one question
yes.
on that topic? Mr. McNevin, you describe, became part of, in charge of bones, and at that time he was the senior scientist in charge of the evidence recovery section, is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. That's all.
What time shall we adjourn to?
Perhaps 2:15.
2:15 it is then.
All rise.